Welcome to the JIMD podcast, your fortnightly helping of inborn errors education. The podcast is intended to help improve the management and understanding of inherited metabolic disease through enhanced communication, both amongst those working in the field, but also our patients and their families. If you're enjoying the podcast, please like or subscribe, but not before listening to this latest episode on liver-directed gene therapy. Hello there. Now, at the end of last year, we shared a glut of podcasts focusing on gene therapy. And after a brief lull, we're returning to the topic. And that's not a surprise because I think genomic therapies are here to stay. Today's episode features the return of two past guests, Dr. Nicola Brunetti-Pieri of the Telethon Institute of Genetics and Medicine in Italy and Dr. Julien Balateau from Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children and the National Institute of Health Research in London. And Nicola and Julien are joined by a newcomer to the podcast, but no stranger to the field, Professor Paul Gissen, who works alongside Julien at GOSH and the National Institute of Health and Research. Nicola, Julien and Paul, good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, as I mentioned, we've been talking a lot about gene therapy in the podcast, and I hope it's something we keep talking about as we see more applications in humans. However, your recent review didn't discuss a specific disorder or group of conditions, but rather organ-targeted treatment, notably the potential for liver-directed gene therapy. There is some overlap here with other podcasts, so please forgive me if I occasionally reference those and we try and stay on new ground. But given we're talking about the liver as a target, I think it's fair to say, at least I hope it is, that gene therapy tends to be quite targeted as opposed to hitting lots of organs at once. Is the liver a good target or a bad one?
Well, the liver is an excellent target for gene therapy. It has several advantages. The first one is the fact that this organ is receiving the blood from two different circulation, from the hepatic artery and from the portal vein. So every single vector that you inject in the bloodstream will easily reach the liver. The other aspect is the fact that the microarchitecture of this organ is very much optimized for exchanges between the bloodstream, the capillary sinusoids, and the liver cell, the hepatocytes. And these capillary sinusoids have in their walls some little holes that are called fenestrations, which enable a very easy crossing of any vector coming from the bloodstream directly very close to the hepatocytes. So this is an organ which has a large population of homogeneous cells as well, which are easier to target, very metabolically active, and they have a large number of secreted proteins as well synthesized by the liver, like enzymes for lysosomal storage diseases or clotting factors. So this is very much an ideal target to treat liver diseases. But of course, as well, some liver diseases will have as well some other symptoms. And in a way, when we treat the liver with the gene therapy, we can as well benefit other organs. And we can even consider the liver not only as a target for gene therapy, but as a proper platform to be able to synthesize a specific protein that could be secreted and be uptaken by other organs and benefit other organs in the body. Another aspect is the fact that the liver is quite tolerogenic, so there is less immune reaction with this organ compared to others. So that list of items are a summary to say that liver is really a good organ for gene therapy. In terms of difficulties with this organ, this is one of the largest organs in the body. So that means that the dose we inject is based on the body weight or the organ weight. And in that sense, we need a significant amount of vector to inject. But because of the advantages we have discussed before and the very easy reach of vector to the hepatocytes, we can in a way reduce the dose. An aspect as well, which is important for pediatric gene therapy, is the fact that the liver is a rapidly growing organ. And in that sense, for vectors bringing transgene which are not integrating in the host genome, this might be a long-term problem.
So it's an easy organ to aim at. So perhaps now we can talk about vectors. I mean, what's so great about AAVs anyway?
Well, I'm going to take this question, James. You're kind of pointing me towards AAVs straight away. So let's just subdivide the vectors because there are different approaches to gene therapy and targeting the liver and trying to address the positives as well as the challenges that targeting liver brings. So you could have viral and non-viral vectors, and the non-viral vectors, you could call it lipid nanoparticles. They are obviously excellent vectors, but they're particularly good at bringing in RNA, not so good at the moment for DNA. But of course, millions of people have been exposed to lipid nanoparticle vectors and mRNA with the vaccines that we got against COVID that was both the BioNTech and Moderna and perhaps some other vaccines. So many of us have been exposed and know about the lipid nanoparticles as vectors. So that's the biggest vector that is already there. And then we can look at the viral vectors. And yes, AAVs are the ones that have been in the press most recently and have achieved successes, including those that are targeting liver and bringing the DNA gene therapies into market. A couple already been approved, and that's the Hemgenix and Roctavian for hemophilia A and B. So we know that it's possible to take the AAV gene therapies from not just treating mice and doing the proof of concept studies, but also going all the way through clinical trials, phase three, and to approval. Your question is, what's so good about AAVs? Well, start with the positives. They are mostly non-toxic. There is very little toxicity that's been observed from the AAVs. Although, yes, there are some studies that show also some adverse events, particularly in the higher doses. So that's that. They're not supposed to be causing disease. They can take up to 4.7 kb of the DNA, and they are traditionally described as non-integrating vectors. I think that statement is now clearly not the case. They are not very good at integration, and the integration is quite random. And also, the integration is not necessarily the transgene integration. So it's there, but we've not seen any genotoxicity, as far as we know, from these random integration events. So they may be a positive events rather than negative events, in fact. They do go into the liver very well, probably much better than any other organs. And as Julian described, whatever you inject sort of ends up in the liver. However, the fact that they're not integrating is causing some issues in that if you are treating small children and infants, when the organism undergoes very rapid growth, because of the non-integration nature, they are not passed on to the next generation of the replicating cells. And therefore, just from that, you would expect dilution effect. There may be some reduction in the activity from some other events that we not really understand very well, but that would be probably the AAVs. They are relatively immunogenic, and there is some baseline seropositivity in the population against the AAVs. So if you are looking for patients who are seronegative for AAVs, then you'll probably exclude a significant proportion. And for some AAVs, up to 50% of the population will not be eligible. And then, of course, once you inject them, you get antibodies as well as cell-mediated toxicity against the AAVs. So it would be challenging to redose. It hasn't been done in humans yet. It's possible there are some various strategies being developed for potentially redosing with AAVs, and maybe that will come. And if it does come, then that would be a very exciting progress as well. Then perhaps the final vector to mention is the lentiviral vectors. Basically, they're retroviruses. And initially, the gamma retrovirus and now lentivirus have been used a lot in the ex vivo gene therapy for now maybe over 30 years. So their pros and cons are well known. They have also been given in vivo. So they've been given in the brain injections and also eye injections, but never been given systemically. And the concerns there, particularly with the integration. Now here, they're very efficient at integrating and you get the transgene integration. So exactly what you want. But of course, the integration is semi-random and the leukemic events happened in the ex vivo gene therapy. So these are the concerns that you don't know what sort of surveillance you would need if you were to go with in vivo lentiviruses. Of course, the other advantage, they have much larger transgene capacity. So you could put bigger transgenes that wouldn't fit into the AAV vectors. You can put more than one transgene. So I think these advantages are perhaps enough said about the various vectors, because there are more interesting things to hear about. Over to you.
Those are the vectors. They're getting the material into the cell. Once it's there, what are the different strategies for changing the DNA as such?
I guess in brief would be that the traditional strategy is the gene addition. And that's what I've been talking about for the last few minutes. Essentially, when you add gene to the cell, whether it is sitting as the extra chromosomal element, the episome, or whether it is integrated into the genomic DNA, as well as the gene that's already there, which is presumably mutant, you are adding another one. So the more recent strategies for gene therapy were either using mRNA, where you don't actually need to deliver the genetic material into the nucleus, it stays cytoplasmic, and that's why the lipid nanoparticles are pretty good. Or actually the most exciting thing and most recent thing is doing gene editing, where you can either replace the whole genomic fragment, the smaller the better, or sometimes you target a particular mutation, which might be very person specific. So there are various strategies using CRISPR-Cas systems. There are base editing, prime editing. There are sort of different ways you can exchange nucleotides and use the additional technologies to do it very precisely. One particular study that has been published using gene editing to knock down a gene, to stop the transcription of a particular gene, transthyretin, that's in the transthyretin-related amyloidosis. So there are very preliminary data being published in New England Journal. And that just shows just how much excitement there is, where even the essentially a phase one study was already published. More studies, I'm sure, are coming. At the moment, it's a bit unclear as to how much off-target effect we will see with these CRISPR approaches. But anyway, back to you, and I'm sure people will want to hear from somebody else.
No, not at all. I mean, it's fascinating to hear about, and I guess these are things we will hear more about in the future. Certainly within this review, we're discussing some very specific disease targets. And first up, you talk about urea cycle disorders, but it really wasn't so long ago that Julie and I discussed those. So perhaps I could say to listeners, go and listen to that podcast, and we could jump straight to Krigler-Najar syndrome, because over almost 4 years of the podcast, this has never come up. So briefly, what is Krigler-Najar and what role is there for gene therapy here?
Yeah, so I will jump in now. The Krigler-Najar syndrome has been a target for gene therapy for many years, actually. If you go back to the initial literature on gene therapy, you will find the gun rats, so a spontaneous animal model of Krigler-Najar, as one of the diseases that has been studied from the very beginning in gene therapy. So this is a defect of an enzyme that is only present in the liver, and the enzyme adds glucuronic acid to bilirubin, thus allowing excretion of bilirubin. If this enzyme is not working, there is accumulation of bilirubin in the blood, then the bilirubin starts to accumulate into tissues, and particularly in the brain, causing neurotoxicity that is severe and irreversible and can even cause death. This disorder is treated currently with either phototherapy, so exposure of the body to UV lights, the same UV lights used in the NICU, for example, but for the entire life of the individual. The alternative treatment is the liver transplantation. And therefore, gene therapy has been a very attractive option as an alternative for liver transplantation that used to be the treatment of choice of many patients at some point in their lives because of the inconvenience related to the phototherapy. Because the enzyme is only expressed in the liver cells, you just need to correct the defect in the hepatocytes. Therefore, this disorder has been an excellent target for gene therapy. And also another reason why this was selected many years ago as a good target is because you likely need a small percentage of hepatocytes to be corrected to provide a significant clinical benefit. Indeed, it has been estimated that 5 to 10% of hepatocytes expressing the enzyme will be sufficient to convert a severe phenotype into a moderate or mild phenotype. It has been a long journey, but eventually led to a phase 1-2 study with the AAV vectors that we just heard that has shown very promising results in terms of reduction of the bilirubin levels.
It certainly sounds very promising, and you've said that work's been published quite recently, is that right?
Yeah, the work has been published a few months ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it's a multi-center international trial that involved multiple centers in Europe and showed in the high dose significant reduction of the bilirubin, and the patients in the high dose cohort were able to stop the phototherapy. So that was the very meaningful clinical outcome of the trial, because the bilirubin level were down to levels that did not require the phototherapy for several weeks post-injection. They were not normalized, but they were significantly reduced. They were below a threshold for toxicity of the bilirubin.
And obviously, that being adults, we hope they're not going to need to be redosed anytime soon.
Yeah, we hope that expression lasts for as long as possible. The hemophilia A and B studies suggest that that expression may be lasting for several years. Particularly the hemophilia B trial suggests that. The hemophilia A, it's a bit more controversial on the duration of the expression. But as Paul mentioned earlier, unfortunately, these patients are unlikely to be dosed with the same vector again because they have developed antibodies against the serotype of AAV that was infused in those patients. Another important point, it's also related to the points that were discussed by Julian and Paul before, is that this trial enrolled patients above the age of 10 based on the assumption that the liver growth would be completed by that age. This is likely related to the problem of the vector dilution that is a concern for infusion of gene therapy early on in life.
So exciting progress, but a bit of a watch this space kind of thing. I'm going to ask again that we do a bit of jumping. We're going to go past the organic academias, as I've previously discussed these with Chuck Venditti, and actually we're looking to return to the topic quite soon as well. So the next thing you brought up is Wilson's disease, another new one for the podcast. I mean, what's the story there?
So Wilson's disease is caused by the deficiency of this transporter of copper encoded by the ATP7B gene. And in case of deficiency of this gene, there is accumulation of copper in the liver and in the body in general, leading to symptoms affecting the brain, the eye, the kidney. And the current treatment based on zinc and a copper chelator like penicillamine have sometimes some side effects and some efficacy, but needs to be taken lifelong. And especially that some patients as well might develop some very severe long-term complications on the in the brain or in the liver. So this type of treatment with the gene therapy is really attractive for this condition. There have been some preclinical studies in a mouse model, which is recapitulating the human phenotype. The main difficulty in this condition is the fact that the ATP7B transporter is encoded by the large transgene, which is slightly above the capacity of the AAV vector that Paul mentioned. And so the first proof of concept with the full length of the gene shows some effect, but limited. And so additional studies have shown that when we truncate slightly the gene, developing some mini version of this ATP7B gene, the effect is much better. And so this has been proven in this animal model, and this has led to two clinical trials which are recruiting in the US and in Europe. And we do hope that this will benefit the patients long term.
Maybe I will jump in on the Wilson because I think it's an interesting example of a disease that can be targeted by genome editing, actually, because there has been recent work showing that the cells that have been corrected for the copper metabolism defect have a proliferative advantage over the resident hepatocytes that are uncorrected, and they can repopulate the liver. So that actually is something that investigators can take advantage of in terms of increasing the efficiency of the genome editing that is, for most cases, relatively low.
I mean, that's obviously exciting. It sounds good from a continuing on perspective if these cells have a survival advantage. But Julian, you mentioned that they're truncating the gene. We're making new genes effectively for people. I know we are putting in a new gene that's different to the one that's got a variant in, but are we effectively creating a gene that is not the normal gene, or am I just misunderstanding that?
In this transporter, there are six different copper binding domains. And so the purpose of engineering this new version of the gene, this mini gene, was to decrease this number of this metal binding domains from 6 to 2. And this enabled the transgene to fit in the vector properly. And in fact, the efficacy was better with this mini gene because we are able to have more AAV particles with the whole transgene.
That's incredible what people can do. Can we finish the wrap up with a quick look at PKU? It's one of the most common IMDs. It's a popular topic on the podcast. Is it a good candidate for gene therapy?
Well, maybe if we're taking turns, I can start and tell you what I'm quite interested in there. And maybe others could also share their experience. I think PKU is, of course, a prime target. Exactly for the reasons you said, because it's one of the commonest diseases that we treat in metabolics area. Not only that, it's, you know, one of the first disease that is screened in the neonatal screening. It requires a very high level of monitoring and a lot of input from the medical care point of view. So, of course, from that point of view, it's a very attractive disease to work on. Of course, there is a successful therapy, which is diet. So I think that's where the question arises, you know, should we be using something that is quite invasive compared to something that is just a diet? And I'm deliberately saying just a diet to wind a lot of people up. But also, of course, the long-term risks are not completely known. Although again, that's a sort of provocative statement. We have got 15 plus years follow-up in these same studies that Nicola mentioned in hemophilia, where there is no particular long-term problems that can occur apart from potentially reduced efficacy. The other thing, of course, that we need to keep in mind, we haven't mentioned that yet, but we can't get away without mentioning the cost. The manufacturing costs of the AAV vectors are astronomical. It's absolutely astronomical. And unless the manufacturing is sorted, it's going to continue to cost 2, 3, 4, 5 million per patient. Is this really justified to have such an expensive therapy for a disease that can be treated with a diet? I think a lot of patients don't want to carry on with the diet if there are alternatives. And a lot of patients even happy to have the Biomarin Palynziq regular injections to replace the diet. So I think it's an interesting one, both in terms of costs, in terms of ethics, in terms of what patient choice. There are a lot of questions there to answer. But from the point of view of the disease target, I think it's great. If you sort out the liver cells, then that should be okay. But I welcome other people's views.
I agree. It's an interesting discussion. And PKU is also an interesting target because of the percentage of hepatocytes that needs to be corrected to achieve a significant benefit. Based on preclinical studies, you probably need a small number of hepatocytes expressing the phenylalanine hydroxylase to significantly reduce the phenylalanine level in blood.
I agree with what has been said because of the high prevalence of the condition and an easy animal model as well, which is not dying very early on. This is an area where you have lots of proof of concept that are being developed in this animal model with all the technologies that Paul mentioned initially, with AAV, with the base editing, with the nucleases, with mRNA approaches. So this is very much an area where there is a lot of active research.
You've talked a lot about exciting areas. Paul's kind of brought up the elephant in the room here, which is there are a number of issues, but cost is going to be a big consideration going forward. I suppose there's two aspects to cost. There's the R&D cost, but you, as you say, there's a genuine manufacturing cost. Is this something that could get more manageable? I mean, we know that Elon Musk has made going to space cheaper. Do we just need Elon to take on gene therapy? Can we make gene therapy more affordable, or is it always going to be exorbitant? Is that because it just genuinely costs a lot of money to make viral vectors?
Well, I can start. So the manufacturing costs are very high. They're in the millions when you are making enough vector, particularly for systemic administration. So you need larger amount of vector because you're doing it per kilo. And you have to have really massive vats 250 liter vats, and you probably need several of these just per patient. That's why the costs are so high. So the efficiency has to change. Well, both the efficiency of vectors targeting the liver, if we're talking about the liver, but also the ability to produce such large amounts of vector. At the moment, with AAV vector manufacturing, I don't particularly see where these efficiencies are going to come. But obviously, if a lot more research is done, because we're doing the proof of concept, more and more rare and rarer diseases can be potentially treated. But if we're talking about VC investment, they need to make the money back. And how are they going to be making money back if actually your cost of manufacturing, as well as R&D, but R&D, I guess, is not going to change. So they need to price these drugs very, very high. And we're only going to rich countries because the not so rich countries can't afford these drugs. So you create more and more inequality. That's one thing. But also the companies actually and venture capitalists are not interested in developing these rare disease drugs because they know that they won't make the money back. So there needs to be a massive decrease in the manufacturing costs. There are alternatives. So we started with lipid nanoparticles. I think there's quite a lot of development going in the lipid nanoparticles. They are much, much cheaper to make. At the moment, they are not so effective at getting into the nucleus. That's why the RNA is okay. The DNA is not so okay. So there is excitement, but for mice, you only need a little bit. For a human, you need a lot. It's difficult.
Do you think that the work with sickle cell and CRISPR-Cas9 is going to help anything here? Because that's a disease that is common and also more prevalent in low-income countries. Is that going to be an incentive to change?
So you're talking about Casgevy and the gene editing. So that's an ex vivo gene therapy, and that's slightly different. It's still very expensive to make because you're making a cell and gene product. There is a lot of work going on to make that, again, the manufacturing costs a bit cheaper, but they're still very expensive. So I think both the vector production and the sort of cell production is really expensive. So these therapies, for example, like the one for MLD, Libmeldi, which is approved in Europe, but not by FDA. That's, I think, at the moment, the most expensive therapy in Europe. That's about 3.5 million or something like that.
Yeah, in low-income countries, the ex vivo gene therapy is also complicated by the fact that you need hospital facilities that are equipped for a bone marrow transplantation. Because after all, the ex vivo gene therapy is a very sophisticated bone marrow transplantation. It's autologous, of course, but it still requires a bone marrow facility.
I think the economic model, which is currently in place, that will be very interesting to see how the space will move on in the next 5-10 years, because there are more and more products being approved and coming to the market, and see how sustainable it will be for the insurance private systems. There is a balance because, of course, the companies need to be able to carry on their work and be able to make some return on investment. But at the same time, it needs to be taken up by the patients. And this is another aspect, just aside of the economic model itself. This is still some, you know, new technologies, and people are watching very closely the follow-ups of the patients who have been injected. And we need to ensure that long-term safety is met, which seems to be the case in most cases, but that's still something that people are looking at. And overall, when we have products available, the patients need to have the reassurance and need to be able to agree to take up these medications. For example, the first AAV gene therapy product, which was developed in 2012, this Glybera for lipoprotein lipase deficiency, were priced at around 1 million euros with some debatable efficacy, but still only one or two patients benefited from this product over a period of some years. So when you have a product in place, we need to have enough confidence between professionals and when we speak with families so that these medications can be taken up.
I mean, this podcast has been a bit of a roller coaster. We've been really excited about all these new ideas, and then suddenly you've told me all these reasons where we potentially can't deliver these products. These challenges, they're surmountable, right?
We would like to believe that they will be surmountable. I think there are economic issues in the world that the four of us wouldn't be able to solve. We can certainly discuss them, though, and that's the fun of it. The technical issues, hopefully, the more people work on this, the more likely they will be solved. And of course, going into the commoner diseases, that will attract more research into the process development, manufacturing, and hopefully rare diseases that we are most interested in will also benefit from that. So we sort of start from rare diseases, then run into problems that the expectations are that the treatments should make the same amount of money for the industry as the common diseases do. So then they drop it, move to common, then hopefully come back to the rare. So let's see. Yeah, it's certainly always exciting. The science is always exciting, and rare diseases are more exciting than common ones in our view, obviously. That's why we're in it. But let's hope that things will move on.
I think that, when there is some compromise between, companies and healthcare systems, I think there is really a role for patients to be able to help stakeholders and decision makers to get these therapies more accessible, more available. They can really push to help politicians or, institutions to make these highly priced medications available for the patients. This is, I think, an encouraging point that we can mention. And the other aspect is the fact that, as Paul was saying, rare diseases and especially inherited metabolic diseases here are very much at the forefront of these novel technologies with lots of new editing technologies, gene therapy in general, which are being tested in these conditions. So that's very exciting for us as professionals to be able to get access to these medications and be able as well to work here where this space is changing so quickly.
I will echo Julian's comment on the importance of studying inherited metabolic diseases. Actually, some of the very first example of gene therapy has been back in the 70s for metabolic diseases. And over the years, studying these disorders have been instrumental to understand complex diseases, but also developing treatment for these disorders has been instrumental for developing treatment for more common disorders. So there are challenges, of course, but every time there is something new, there are always challenges. Hopefully, they would be solved.
I like what you mentioned, Nicola, because look at human genome. A few countries got together and decided that they're going to solve it. They're going to sequence human genome. And they did it. They put the money together and they did it. And we do have now whole genome sequencing that in some countries available on the health service. In the UK, maybe with some delay, we can sequence patients. So now we can diagnose patients. We need to make the next step. And maybe what we need is more sort of combined collaborative thinking between the rich countries of this world and say, okay, we need to put money into solving these diseases. And then certainly if they put the money in, serious money in, not coming from just directly from industry where they want to make money, then it could be solved, in the manufacturing problems and others. Some of it is happening already in Italy, happening certainly in the UK. There are gene therapy manufacturing hubs that are financed by the government. So it can be done. But I think the sort of thinking together and appreciating that this is an important problem is a big step.
Certainly optimistic outlook for the world political future, but we will keep our fingers crossed. And I'm certainly grateful that all of you continue to kind of lead the way in your fields and to take this forward. And I'm also grateful that you've been able to give up your time this morning. And certainly if you're listening and that's whet your appetite, then you might want to look for our episode with Julianne discussing gene therapy and urea cycle disorders, or Nicola's discussion on mucopolysaccharidoses. And of course, you can find this paper by clicking the link in the podcast description or by going to the journal website and searching for liver-directed gene therapy. Julianne, Nicola and Paul, thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, James.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And thank you for listening. Until next time, goodbye.